I've got a load of Fosters left.
Sessionable. Ashes to ash and fun to fuck it. We know Major Tom's a junkie, strung out in heaven's high, hitting at all time low.
Welcome to Sessionable, a very special episode of Sessionable. This is our UK special. And we've got some guests in the house, which is fun.
Yeah.
Woo.
So in addition to myself, Adrian and Liam,
yep.
We also have Brad.
Hi.
And Willie.
Hello.
So,
how are you?
Honoured are we to be invited onto this illustrious podcast.
Well, honoured are we to have experts in UK beer, right?
Ah, well, yeah. Self-professed experts, that's certainly, yeah.
You know more than we do, so...
So, we thought we'd kick off the episode with probably one of the most famous UK beers.
Yeah.
It's definitely when I think, what's English for beer? It's the answer is of course, Foster's.
A long neck of Foster's.
Yes.
Yeah.
Premium quality.
Premium quality Foster's. Goodness me.
Australia's famous beer.
Well, you know what? I had my very first Foster's in England, so...
I think I did as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, so did I. but I would just like to say, I think that the draft Foster's that everyone knows and tries to avoid is actually about 3.3 or 3.4%. This premium quality bottle version is 4.9%.
We have Imperial Foster's.
And is this, I assume this is brewed in Australia?
Yeah. It'd be brewed.
Okay. Yeah, that one you've got is brewed in Australia. The one in Britain is brewed by what was Scottish Newcastle Breweries in a brewery which is neither in Scotland nor in Newcastle.
It's a whole new level of piss. Absolutely.
That's weird.
Is it just a trough that runs from the primary school bathrooms straight into the brewery?
we won't say too much about this one, because, I mean, what is there to say, really? It's, you know, it's like Sex in a Canoe, it's all of those ones.
Yeah. It's,
it's so sweet, isn't it?
It is very sweet.
It's just, I don't know whether I prefer the weaker one or not, because...
I probably would.
At least you can kind of ignore that one.
Yeah.
The weaker one works in Britain when it's a hot day. So,
once a year.
If you want your first quenched, that's the beer to go for if you actually want to taste something by a proper beer. So.
Then what was the Foster's export?
Would that be this one?
It must be this one, I don't know.
Because that would come in cans as well. It would be like a cream-coloured can.
I'd say...
Going right back into the 1970s for the Foster's export, so that was the one brewed in Australia. Sent across the world, so you've got your... you know, those famous, like, giant cans that you had.
Yeah.
Know, Britain and America had them.
So it's like a reverse India Pale Ale, almost.
I suppose.
Anti-India Pale Ale, I would say, yeah.
The colony is sending it back.
Yeah.
Thanks for the IPAs. Here's something back. I will say, brilliant clarity for this one. Probably the only...
Yours has no head retention, though.
Only good thing... Well, that's probably the glass.
Possibly.
It is very clear.
it's almost
yours
like
looks
water.
Like a cider, Adrian.
Yeah, mine looks like a cider.
It's about as sweet as well.
I think I would prefer a cider.
All right, I'm just going to scull up.
Yeah, all right.
Yep. Just like...
I'd love to be able to give you some figures on Foster's, but I didn't actually look into how many units are sold.
I was going to say...
average year, the answer is far too many in the UK.
Yeah. I was going to say, scull it like an Aussie teenager, but no Aussie teenager drinks this.
Yeah.
Well, you know, every, like, 10 years, like, there's always this, like, hipster revival of Foster's.
Is it like the PBR of Australian beer?
I think Resch's is like the PBR of Australia.
It is. It definitely would say so. Yeah.
Hang in there, soldier. Hang in there.
So while we're sort of getting the next beer prepared, which I promise is better,
can I just say though, it's actually quite pertinent to have Foster's as the first beer because there's this whole ridiculous notion in the UK that this is what Australian beer is about, you know. Mm. And I must admit, when I first came to this country, there was a real sense of trepidation about what I was going to find beer-wise at the other end. And then having actually come over here and being able to find good beer was just a massive relief to me, because everybody in the UK thinks that this is what Australian beer is.
No one in Australia drinks Foster's, is the great irony of it. Mm. Well, that actually, I think that leads us in pretty well. So we might talk about sort of your beer backgrounds. We'll start with you, Brad, and then we'll go on to Willie. So, like, what got you into craft beer? Why, you know, do you love it so much? What sort of, what did you grow up, I mean, not grow up on, but, like, what did you drink in England that you really liked? And
well, I was quite a late starter with beer. I was quite a good boy and quite studious while I was at school. So I only really started drinking probably at about the age of 17, if I'm honest. Before that, it was just the odd sip of my dad's pint of Theakston's, which he tended to do a favour. Our producer will appreciate that one.
Yeah.
But started off just drinking the mainstream crap, like most people would do.
Yeah.
Went off to university, and cider was my beer of my beer. Cider was my drink of choice then. And it wasn't the good cider either. It was really poor, again, mass-produced cider, generally mixed with blackcurrant cordial. So I would drink into the double figures pints of that, and that carried on for maybe a couple of years. And then all of a sudden, I can't remember how it happened, but I went to a Canberra beer festival in Leicester, where I went to university, and my world changed pretty much overnight. I've managed to try many beers during that first session. There are a few that sort of stick in my mind, and I think we'll move on to at least one of those later on in the episode. But yeah, I just came away with my mind blown, thinking, okay, so this is what's good about beer, not that rubbish. I mean, the reason I favoured cider was just I could not drink lager. I just absolutely hated the taste of it, I have never ever got any enjoyment out of the mainstream lager. So.
That's just me.
Our producer just topped
up. I don't want any more
Brad's glass.
I don't want any more of that Foster's. So yeah, I mean, my story is it was very much, you know, as a bohemian university student, it was one of the things that I managed to discover, and I just, you know, kind of took it away from Leicester, came back to London. I actually found it a much more difficult task to find good beer in London. At that time, it was just very, very hard to come by. So as a card-carrying camera member during that time, I was kind of chasing the beer festivals around the country, and I sort of averaged maybe 6 or 7 a year.
Oh, wow.
Going to various cities, and actually saw quite a bit of the country in doing so. So
was there a lot of difference between the different venues for the, like, as far as what they had on offer?
You tend to see some of the same beers that would show up at every festival. One that really sticks in my mind is Sarah Hughes Dark Ruby Mild, which was like a 6% mild. And you'd see that at every single beer festival. Yeah, and it always came in these massive, great big casks compared to the rest as well. Oh, so nice. That certainly did the circuits. But what I liked about it is if you'd go to these different local festivals, and they'd all specialise in their local beers. So they'd have their local beers as the real showcase, and then it'd be, and we've got this other stuff around the country as well. The first time I came across BrewDog was actually at one of these local beer festivals, that really did blow my mind when we discovered them. But you know, it tended to be, you'd see the same sort of stuff all the time.
Excellent. And what about you, Willie? What's your beer story?
Yeah, it's quite a long story, I guess. Clearly a bit old, but I started drinking decent beer a long, long time ago. Both my dad and my bigger brother was very much into real ales. This is going back into the mid 80s, and ever since then it has had to be proper beer. And of course I arrived in Australia 20 years ago, and things were a lot bleaker than they were, so I was just about to go straight back, but met my wife and stuck around. Back in Britain, I was 2IC of a couple of real ale pubs in Edinburgh. One of the pubs has 14 different, you know, constantly rotating, independent, mainly Scottish beers, but quite a lot of the English stuff as well. And so around that time, I got to taste you know, I would say probably about 80% of the beers that were available in Britain at that time. And of course, you're talking 20 years ago, so it was way less, way fewer beers than are actually available now. But it was certainly a great education and start into beer. Came over here, had to get into wine for a while, and finally, I guess about 5 years ago, we've had a bit of a renaissance, and we're back into beer in a big way.
Excellent. And we might. So we've got we've got our next beer. But both of you have sort of mentioned this thing called Camera. What's Camera?
So the campaign for Real Ale is officially the world's most successful consumer organisation. It was founded in 1971. If you go back into the 60s, all of your brewery amalgamations, all of your changes in production methods, changes in distribution meant that beers were becoming blander and there was fewer and fewer different brands available. And particularly in Britain, ale was still popular. So unlike everywhere else in the world, which had gone into lagers, ale was still popular. So the bigger breweries started producing kegged beer. So they basically pasteurise the beer, chuck it into a great big can, and then send it out to the pubs. Your traditional British beer, of course, was the cask-conditioned one. So, you know, it undergoes a secondary fermentation in the cask, which is always going to bring out more character into the beer. But it takes a lot of skill from a publican to actually get that right. So, you know,
it takes a lot of work as well, doesn't it?
An awful lot of work. So that's difficult. It's effectively a premium product, but of course the people who drink the stuff aren't willing to pay a premium price for it. It's the traditional stuff. It's seen in a lot of the older style pubs. And unfortunately, that was dying out and being replaced by this bland or mass-produced kegged beer. So four guys in 1971 founded this organisation, and of course it spread pretty quickly across Britain. They're a big, they stand up to the government, they put on protest marches. But of course, what we now do, the main two things that we do, is we produce a book called The Good Beer Guide, which lists the pubs in Britain with the best beer. And they organise virtually every beer festival across the country. So they actually have a huge amount of power in, you know, the beer community and the good beer community.
I think it's worth saying, you know, they did an awful lot of good work.
Absolutely.
I mean, at the time that you know, we're going back to when they were founded, there was the big six breweries that kind of controlled, I think it's 83% of all beer that was drunk in pubs was from these huge breweries and this mass produce, you know, for want of a better word, tripe that was in these sealed kegs, flavourless, bland, boring. And, you know, it took these guys, these revolutionists, to say, you know, this is not what we, you know, we don't want to see all of our good beer die out. And at the time, it was very much a case of keep the real ale, or the cask-conditioned beer, or just accept the fate of this bland rubbish that you know, doesn't taste anything.
And you look at what they've done, you know, they really had a huge influence across the rest of the world as well. I mean, you go to America, all those guys who started up, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, you know, those original craft brewers in America, they were very, very influenced by what Camera had done and by those British beers that they'd saved.
I think the one thing that I really liked what Camera did is, like, you guys have such a great regionality with your breweries, and, like, it's all about the location, and you go to Leicester, you know, they drink this, you go Newcastle, they drink that, and we don't really have that here. Like, it's, you drink VB or you drink Tui's, like, or Foster's. But what I really loved is that deep rich history of, like, the localities of the breweries and drinking local.
Yeah, I mean, I think the localness is something that's sort of how it started before, you know, the beer miles came in, and we're talking about much fewer miles in the UK, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think it's something they actually had to artificially try and push in the latter years. So one of the camera schemes was this locale scheme, whereby you could put a particular badge on your beer if you were within 25 miles of the brewery. And a lot of the local camera organisations were encouraged to push their local beers. And for me, you know, as a beer tourist travelling around the country,
you want to try everything.
That's what I wanted to see. You know, I wanted to see the beers that were local to that part of the world.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, and you're right. And there are different characteristics in different parts of the country. You know, we probably won't get into the sparkler debate today, but you know, sort of methods of dispense and types of beer that will succeed in one part of the country that won't in another. Mm. And you know, there's a lot of variation, as we all know. There's a huge amount of variation in beer, and you know, even in a little tiny island like the UK, there's a huge amount of variation.
Ah,
there.
So much more than
definitely. I think we're starting to see a bit of that in, like, especially in the craft scenes between Melbourne and Sydney. You know, you think of a brewery like,
let me guess what
it
is. He's wearing an
Australian brewery, maybe.
No. But like a brewery like Riverside, we as Sydney craft beer drinkers, we drink Riverside all the time. You know, we know the guys. But then you go to Melbourne, and it's not necessarily as I'm not going to say not ubiquitous, but not as like.
I think Riverside's a bit different, where it's like there hasn't been a lot of Riverside beers.
Young Henry's is the same. They don't expand.
Well, it's more because they can't make enough beer.
Yes, yeah, right. Like, absolutely. It's not a demand choice. So high. It's out of the fact that they can only just about service their local
area. I think in the last month, it's like the first time Riverside's been on tap in Victoria outside of a Good Beer Week scenario.
Because I know like the local tap house is Share Kegs.
But outside of that, you don't really find it. I think True Brew has it.
True Brew has. I think. Who had the Hoppy Beers Festival? Our House Project.
Another huge factor in Britain, which isn't necessarily the campaign for real ale, is the fact that most of the small breweries own a number of local pubs as well. So the actual, you know, most pubs in Britain were tied to a certain brewery. There weren't too many free houses. Now there's more and more. They'll produce anyone's.
Yeah.
But you know, you'll actually go into a lot of pubs in the local area and they'll only have the beers from that one single brewery, which, you know, is just unheard of here.
Yeah. Well, even 5 years ago when I was in London and I worked in a pub, and I worked for a Marston's pub. So it was actually, they still own, Marston's still to this day own like a big chain of pubs throughout the UK. And, you know, we had a rotating 5 hand pumps serving cask, but it was all Marston's own,
all from that stable. Absolutely. And some of the bigger regionals like Marston's, they're a good example. Fuller's are another example. Green King, if I dare say the words, are another example as well. You know, they're very protective about keeping beers from their stable. These are the sort of predatory breweries that will go out and they'll buy other smaller breweries up if they see that they're succeeding. Generally move their production in-house and completely obliterate the beers that were there before
And very much a regional thing. So if you look at Fuller's, it's very much a London-based one.
Definitely.
Marston's is Bourne-upon-Trent. So, you know, they are still seen as regional brewers, even though they're available nationally.
So what are we drinking?
Well, Marston's is probably a pretty good segue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Very good segue into this.
This was one of the beers that we served quite a lot on our hand pump. So this is the Witchwood Hobgoblin, which is a Ruby Ale? Is that what they call it?
It's a Ruby Ale, and it's the fifth best-selling bottled beer in the UK.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, wow. Someone's done some research. This is.
I remember my very first day when I moved into my house in London. Went shopping and went to Asda, and the very first beer I picked up was a Hobgoblin.
Yeah, and if you're going to drink beer in the UK, it won't take you very long to find Hobgoblin. Absolutely. You know, it's you know, pretty much in every supermarket. They've been around for quite a long time. But talking about sort of, you know, successful smaller breweries getting bought out by the bigger ones, Witchwood was brought out by Marston's.
I thought this would be a good one to bring along, because if you go back 20 years when I was there, this was one of the most popular independent ones, and they really made a big deal about that, and you know, it was actually quite obvious it was quite difficult to get up in Scotland because it was still quite regional from down in Oxfordshire.
And rightly so, you know, big flavours for a cask beer. Yeah. It came in at 5.6% back then, and you know, which was
fairly strong.
A significant strength for a UK cask.
I think beer. Anything watering it down ever since. Yeah,
absolutely, I mean, this is one of the bad things about you know, these buyouts is that this beer went from 5.6%, it then went down to 5%. And then when Marston's came in, the cask version went down to 4.5%. Wow. So you're taking out characteristics of the beer.
Because the bottle we're drinking now is 5.2%.
5.2, yeah. So they've now got a disparity between the cask and the
wow, so they're
the
doing bottle, two different bottle batches. Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's, you know, some of the bigger beers, some of the bigger ales in the UK continue to work like that. So the bottle will sometimes will be stronger than
if you look at how the sales work in the UK, that bottle is available in supermarkets. You don't go to a pub and buy bottled beer.
No,
you go to a pub and you buy the draft beer. Yeah. So that's a supermarket product. So you're looking down a supermarket aisle, what's going to make this beer stand out? So you got all of these other 4.5% best bitters, and you go, oh, there's one that's 5.2%, it's the same price, I'm Scottish, I'm going to buy that.
But it's kind of the other way round, I think, a bit, in some extent, on the cask beer. You know, you're attracting, or certainly up until the recent times, you're attracting a certain type of drinker. Mm-hmm. And the British drinker doesn't want to buy beer in the pub that's too strong. So they will look across the hand pumps, and they will look at ones that are around sort of the 4% mark, or maybe even lower than that. If they get to something that's 5%, they just immediately dismiss it. No matter what the beer is, oh, that's too strong, I'm not having a pint of that.
Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
So it kind of works in the reverse, I think, in the cask, which is why the bigger brewers are under pressure to reduce the strengths of the.
And is some of that to do with price point as well? Because I'm not sure, has the British system work as far as taxation?
The more alcohol you have, the more.
So having your cask version at a lower alcohol can get it at a better price point, and
yeah, absolutely. I think 4% is the sort of the key cutoff point, which is why you see a lot of bitters that come in at sort of 3.8-3.9%, because they're trying to stay below that magic sort of 4%.
Well, yeah, producer Lee just wrote a note about BrewDog and their push for different glass sizes, which I think is pretty interesting as well, because that's another, like, almost another opposite to that scale where
it's a great example at beer festivals. When you go to a beer festival, the law says that you can drink a beer in a half pint glass or a pint glass. So you go to a beer festival,
you can grab
200 beers, and you can have either a half pint or in some cases a pint. Usually it's just the half pints that they have available.
Yeah,
you have to have a half pint of every single
They have actually brought in a third now as a legal measure, so you can actually
This is what
only if the beer festival supports it can you have these third measures as well. There's no two-third measure in the UK, it's a third, a half, or a pint.
This is what BrewDog have managed to get in smaller measures, so that they can have these insanely strong beers and actually sell them.
Well, I mean, if you go to a BrewDog bar in the UK, like, you can get some pretty big beers on tap, like,
absolutely,
yeah, even like a Tokyo at a half pint, it's still
half pint
pretty.
Can you not?
Can you not get
tasters?
You can't get a half
pint. No, like
there's
like a legal law about the glass sizes.
I think you cannot buy a half pint of Tokyo.
I think that's dumb.
They sell it in shot glasses. For £6.
So shot glasses are a legitimate measure.
Yeah. Well, there's two sizes of wine glasses. There was the half pint, the full pint. Is that
The wine glass sizes were quite brilliantly 150 mils and 250 mils. So you could have a fifth of a bottle of wine or a third of a bottle of wine. Nice. Quality lawmaking there, thank you.
One thing we can do over there is drink, and drink in quantity. You know?
Yeah, I learned that.
Yeah, that's one thing we can't really do here.
So what do you think about the beer?
Yeah, we can do it.
Yeah. Oh, it's quite nice.
I think it's pretty good.
It's quite a dry finish, doesn't it? Like,
it does have quite a dry finish.
It's got a nice, really nice dark colour.
Yeah.
It does have a touch of sweetness on palate, but it does dry out a bit.
I mean, a lot of toffee.
As Australians, I would say this is quite very much a traditional ale from the British stable. Mm. As Australians who perhaps aren't subjected to this style all the time, what do you make of this? Do you have the sort of sense of this comes from
it does to me, like drinking this beers that have this kind of flavour, this sort of feeling, I do very much associate that with British beer, like that sort of, I do make that in association in my head.
I think I have association with British beers and like the malt profile.
Definitely.
I think that's a very
malt driven.
That's a signature character, I think, of
hops,
a lot of
just as bittering, really. And,
and there's more of a balance towards the malt, the sweetness rather than the bitterness.
The malt's a showcase, and like the hops and everything else is just like to support that showcase. Is what the feeling that I get with a lot of English beers.
I mean, for me, this is almost a bit of a relic of a beer. Mm. You know, it's the sort of beer that I started to drink. You know, because it was the sort of beer that I could find in pubs when I started to drink them, and in my mind, the beer world's kind of moved on a bit since then.
I find it hugely interesting when you look at the beers that are being brought in, and like most of these British beers, there's two importers that are bringing most of them in. There's the Beer and Cider Company, which is bringing in all of these traditional British beers. So, you know, your Badgers, your Firsty Ferret, all
Banks,
the Witchwood ones, Banks.
The ones that are all over the supermarkets.
The supermarket beers of the UK. And then you've got the Beer Italiana guys who are bringing in the what we would describe as craft beers. And I find it really interesting that those two portfolios just do not mix at all.
Absolutely.
It's these traditional ones, which again, you know, I look at that and go, well, it's a bit old-fashioned.
Yeah, there's very much the old school and the new school.
Absolutely, and it's two companies that are bringing them all in.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there is sort of like a slight third with Bravo Group, who are sort of...
Phoenix and...
There's very much two different schools, and it's interesting.
So, Willie, are you able to sort of look back nostalgically and say, is this Witchwood Hobgoblin as good as the Witchwood Hobgoblin that you remember, or...?
I certainly enjoyed that. I mean, I'm quite happy to say it doesn't bring back those same that's an amazing beer, which at the time it certainly did. Now that's a pretty good beer. I'm quite enjoying that.
It's very nice.
And it could come from any brewery across the whole world, but it's definitely that like English style.
It's that very malt driven. But quite bitter. Like, it's quite bitter, I think.
It's not Scottish, it's English. It's got bitterness to it.
It might just be worth mentioning the branding that Hobgoblin uses.
They have a very unique... It's very Tolkien-esque, I'd say.
For the last 10 years, they've very much played on being an ale company as opposed to the mass-produced lager. And they've got this slogan that they use, which is... What's the matter, lager boy? Afraid you might taste something. And I'm ashamed to say I had the t-shirt 10 years ago because I thought it was hilarious when I first started getting into beer and becoming what I thought was a better drinker, and taking the piss out of some of my peers who were still drinking this, drinking Foster's.
Exactly.
It didn't take me very long to actually change my mind on that and think that actually it was a little bit wanky,
And especially I find, I look at that and I just think that that's a great example of what we think really old drinkers
Absolutely.
Are into. It's like, The Lord of the Rings, Dungeons and Dragons. let's go out train spotting for the afternoon. It's that real kind of. It strikes me
that
as
camera
being really
almost,
old fashioned.
Yeah.
Are you saying that doesn't happen?
Drinking out of smoking out of a corncob pipe and
and having your beer festival at a rail yard. It's a perfect example of where that beer fits in the world. And you go back 20 years, and that brewery only started in 1981. A relatively new, small brewery.
But they look like, just looking at that, it looks like they've got tradition.
Looks like medieval, absolutely.
Absolutely.
So when did they get bought out?
That was early 21st century, I believe, that they got bought out. I don't have the exact date, sorry, but
early 21st century.
We're currently in the early 21st century.
No, I mean very early 21st century.
Earlier.
Right, okay.
So do you guys find that with craft brewers there is like this kind of shyness to explore these more maltier styles, and they in the UK, I mean, they go for like the kind of the more bitter style.
The UK, I would say probably the main difference is the use of hops, and we'll probably get that onto later on. But very much the traditional style of British beer. These regional breweries and the smaller ones, the ones that have been around for 20 years, the ones that have been around for 150 years, are producing what we would describe as relatively bland beers, whereas the craft guys have just came on and said, let's do some
absolutely.
Crazy stuff.
The hops being used in these sorts of brown bitters, which is what I would refer to them collectively, your Fuggles and your East Kent Goldings, they are hops that are grown in the southeast of England, and they're bittering hops as opposed to aromatic or flavorful hops. Yeah. So, and that's kind of something that, you know, if we're starting to criticize Camera, they've kind of made that continue. You know, it's this perception of the old man, brown beer drinking real ale,
unwilling to adjust to change or.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And and then the new guys have kind of come in and have tried to brighten up the scene
yeah.
a bit more.
I mean, yeah, there was definitely a point where Camera was at that middle roads where they go, do we go with these guys and support them, or do we stick to our ways?
Yeah.
And
as long as they were producing real ale, they were happy to support them.
Yeah.
It was the moment that they stopped, you know, towing
the
camera line.
BrewDog had some very big public outbursts with Camera and about...
Yeah. BrewDog has very big public, lots of things, but...
but I think that at that point in time, it was quite a... It was very relevant what they were doing, and...
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think Camera sees the biggest threat, and you know, undoubtedly the biggest threat to Camera now, and like that, that real ale is actually decent keg.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, if you have decent taste in beer, then in people who want to taste that decent taste in cask beer are going to move over and start drinking the keg, because you go to so many pubs and that cask conditioned beer's gone off. It's gone stale. It's not been well kept.
Well, I mean, yeah, when we ran, like the pub that I ran, like, we'd get like the Camera guys would come around the day before and say, we're all coming in for a drink tomorrow, and so I'll be there till midnight cleaning all the lines and making sure everything's fine. And like this 20 odd people who look like they're in Lord of the Rings with their walking sticks and pipes would come in, and I'd each have like 2 half pints and walk out. I'd be like, what the fuck did I do the whole night? Like, just for these guys to have like a pint. Like,
and very much, I mean, like, you know, certainly in Edinburgh, that was kind of what happened.
Yeah.
Your actual drinkers weren't members of the
Camera. No, not at all.
But there was a vocal minority that would come in. They wouldn't necessarily drink a lot of beer, but they would certainly be
very vocal about it.
But if you wanted to be in the Good Beer Guide,
then
you would need that one-off visit to be a great visit for your pub.
And like, they use that as a threat almost. Like, the fact that they even told us they're coming in the day before they're coming in would be like, you know.
That's not the idea.
Certain ones always would be like that. Most of them are perfectly fine. Most of them are decent guys. But there were certainly a few that were like, you know, well, you know, this is all about you being and still being in the Good Beer Guide.
Yeah, so, exactly.
The Good Beer Guide brings in an awful lot of customers.
Mm,
you know,
it's true.
Not campaign for real ale members. Yeah. A lot of people read that and this is where the decent beer is. These guys, you know, it's going to be a decent pub. Let's
now, is that the book that you were on the cover of, Willie?
No, I was on the cover of a different... I was,
waiting for that.
I was on the cover of the 3rd edition of the Real Ale Drinkers Almanac, which is basically a list of all the breweries and the beers that were available in the late 1980s.
Yeah, there's a photo of a very handsome young Willie on the...
Before most of us were born.
So if you just put into Google handsome young Willy,
your first one,
I'll be the first photo.
Just make sure your mum's not in the room.
I do think that it is a shame that there is that kind of almost mutual exclusivity between, you know, Camera and craft. I think, you know, the stars should be able to overlap.
It's possibly, you know, a little bit unfair, but very simply, campaign for real ale is about real ale. So they have to be campaigning for those cask conditioned beers. Now they've got the opportunity to campaign for different stuff. They see keg beer as a big threat. So the main rule that they actually have, and the one that BrewDog's got the issue with, is that any beer that's available cask conditioned and kegged isn't allowed to be exhibited
in the festival.
Their festivals.
Well, that's a bit silly.
That's
what kicked it all off with.
For instance, if you were Belgian beer, if you're an American beer, you can actually be exhibited no problem at all
in these things.
Kegs. But actual British
craft
beer cannot be done in those festivals, because, and you know, those festivals are where a hell of a lot of people like Brad get their first taste of decent beer. So to exclude decent beers purely on, you know, their
dispensing system, it shouldn't just like I don't know. I feel
it,
like
it doesn't make sense to us, but it makes perfect sense to me. But yeah. it's not going to make sense in Australia.
It was relevant at the time, you know. Absolutely. At the time in 1971, it was relevant to focus on the method of dispense and say beer that was dispensed in this way was better than beer that was dispensed. Yep. And for 40 years, they've been peddling that message that keg beer is crap beer.
And there wasn't a single decent keg beer in Britain for 40 years.
Which is different now.
But only very, very recently. Yeah. We're talking the last sort of 5 years that we've started to get UK brewers moving over to keg, but also, you know, within that time that we've started to get any draft beer coming over from the US as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so before that, you just couldn't get the US stuff unless you had it in bottles. Yeah, it was relevant at the time. It's now not relevant, and my belief is that Camera has missed a trick by not actually jumping on the keg bandwagon.
Yeah, I mean,
they've made themselves more irrelevant to beer nerds as an organisation.
I mean, nowadays they've copped a lot of flack, but no matter what they do now, like you said, it's very important to remember what they did in the past.
Yeah, absolutely.
And where you guys are as a drinking nation or group of nations, whichever you want to go, is because of actions of these people.
They did.
And that's very important.
They did. But does that actually...
Is it dated? Is it relevant now? Yeah. Is a different question.
And again, it's a lot of the forerunners. You know, the guys who are running Camera now are not the same guys who founded it, and not the same guys who ran it for the first 20 years and really made the big differences. But they're guys who have said, this is the line, and...
They're mostly guys who drank with those guys, though.
It is a generational thing.
Certainly
a
generation.
As an outsider looking in, it does seem like, I don't know, the exact same people have just gotten older, and there's been no handover, no...
Well, I remember.
It's an old man's club.
There are individuals.
An old man's club, yeah.
There are individuals who think a different way, but, there's still the company or the organisation line that real ale is the only way.
They have their AGM, and every year they have the same debates, and
nothing changes.
60% of the guys say it has to stay the same, and 40% say we've got to change.
But when
the
they version. Die, maybe is that. Yeah.
I think before that time, there'll come a point when their memberships start flailing, and they might have to go, shit, we actually really, really need to reevaluate what we're doing.
Yeah.
But, so there seems to be now, a very big line between Camera breweries and, I guess you'd say craft might not be the right word, but...
what is craft?
But new age, there's, the new generation, which is not with Camera. Has anyone actually found that middle ground and towed the line between the two, or...?
There are breweries in the UK that are producing both keg beer and cask beer, sometimes of the same beer, and you will sometimes see both styles in the same pub.
Yeah.
The really interesting thing about that is if you do see something like Thornbridge Jaipur on both cask and keg at the same time, the keg version is often much more expensive than the cask one.
Wow.
So even though you talk
but
about
even
you
though,
know,
like,
the
wastage and everything and the work, it's actually more as a bar,
it's a lot easier to serve it in keg
kegs.
Format, absolutely.
Yeah, and it makes you more money. There's a lot of wastage and stuff like that goes with casks. Yep. And
I think it's the perception of the price that you should pay for a cask beer.
But even with there's always been a very big divide between the pricing of your Camera ales and your mainstream lagers.
Well, there's a requirement to turn over cask-conditioned beer quickly because after sort of 3-4 days, it starts to deteriorate.
Exactly.
After 5 or 6 days, it becomes undrinkable.
Yeah. Mm.
So I guess you have to price it sharply in order to turn
keep
over an
moving.
Entire cask of beer, whereas the keg will sit in there a bit longer.
Yeah.
But I think it also comes down to trends as well. You know, your beer hippies who come in and start drinking this keg beer because it's the fashionable thing to do, they will pay £4.80 for a pint of Jaipur, whereas your cask drinkers won't pay any more than £3.30 for a pint.
Do you think it'd be the opposite here, where the beer hipsters would pay extra for a cask beer?
I would argue that they would, Adrian.
I could already do.
Even
it's
if it's
because
the
it's
same
something
from
new
the
that
same
we've
barrel.
Never had here. Like, yeah.
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 And these are simply the correct prices, but the market in Britain suggests that you're a whole bloke, you're only willing to pay this amount for your hand pulled ale, and that's the way that it works.
If I walked to a pub in Sydney right now and they had the same beer on hand pump and on tap but on keg, I would probably start with the hand pump.
Do they actually produce it in a different way, or is it literally just a keg beer that's connected up to a hand
pump? I think most breweries here who do cask beers are yet to fully grasp how to.
There are very few who do actual. I mean, Willie is the expert on this. There are very few who do actual cask ale, and most of the time it's just a degassed keg.
Yeah, basically. That's the feeling I get. I think that's slowly changing.
It is. There are a few casks. Flat Rock, Red Oak.
Yeah.
The local tap house owns a couple of casks that they send out to breweries.
I think Four Pines
use
as well.
Four Pines. Yeah. But that's in Sydney. That's about it for.
But look,
for,
it's for, like hand
cast. Compare that to a year ago.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's still a very new thing, and it's still, it will take time. We'll get there.
I think you've got an interesting divide between cask conditioned and just hand pulled beer in Sydney, and I don't know.
Yeah, like racked into a cask.
So you know, it goes down to that dispense method. So if you serve a beer a little bit warmer with a little bit less carbonation, you're going to get a lot more flavour out
definitely
of the beer. You know, that was certainly part of the appeal of cask-conditioned beer back in Britain.
Yeah.
You know, that beer's not cask-conditioned, but it's got those same qualities.
Yeah.
So, you know, therefore, that still works. It still tastes good. It's still to my taste. It's probably still to Brad's taste. You know, we're actually still going to enjoy it. The actual genuine dispense method, what's going on down in the cellar, is it necessarily relevant?
I very camera much doubt they wouldn't.
Camera
wouldn't.
Certainly wouldn't approve.
Yeah.
Absolutely not.
We're just going to take a break now, just quickly. So we can pour the next beer and we'll talk about ordering pizza as well. So let's do that.
So we've poured our next beer. It is the Fuller's London Porter from London? Is it from London?
It is indeed from London.
From Chiswick.
Fuller's from Chiswick in London. They've been there for 350 years.
Wow.
So it's not like they're not doing a Thunder Road and calling the beer after somewhere nowhere near where it's brewed,
absolutely
right?
Not. Now, this is a genuine London Porter.
Excellent.
True to style. The self-professed by Fuller's world's finest porter. And it's got all of the awards to back that up as well.
Yeah. And I mean, this is one that when you ask a beer expert, or I think Michael Jackson might have named this as one of his top. I don't know. Again, I'm talking shit.
I would hope so.
But this is just a When I think of like London style porter, it makes sense to think of this one.
Yeah, I remember seeing Michael Jackson on tour, and he was drinking this on stage.
Nice.
As he was performing. of course, we're talking about the Michael Jackson beer writer.
Yes, that's
And whiskey.
For a
writer.
Second, I was like, Michael Jackson did a tour? Like, what did he do? He's like, drink beers in front of everyone.
Has anyone seen Michael Jackson on Conan? He used to come on Conan and bring beers to.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Conan makes fun of him a bit, but.
Like. Well, I personally love this beer.
I wasn't really into
porters when I was in London, but I'm really enjoying this. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the first time I've had this beer. I've always had the London Pride before, and never the London Porter.
I've definitely had it before.
Well, London Pride is an interesting one because that's kind of it started off as a regional London beer, and then sort of became a quasi-national. You can find London Pride on cask across the UK from north to south.
For like £2 a pint.
And for that, I would kind of relate Fuller's a little bit to sort of Cooper's in an Australian kind of way. It started off as a regional thing and kind of became a more kind of national brand, and certainly the London Pride is that one. This one's still far more niche, the London Porter, but I think it's an excellent example of the style of the Porter style, and it was one of the first real exciting beers for me that was widely available in the supermarkets as well.
Nice.
Before the supermarkets got wise and started to bring in more and more craft stuff, this was the one you could always go to and buy and have at home.
The interesting thing for me though, like when I go back, or when I was in Britain 20 years ago, this beer didn't actually exist. So this is actually quite a recent one that Fuller's brought out. I mean, probably 15, 20 years ago was probably when we started remaking it.
I think it was less than that. I remember it coming out. So it must be within the last sort of 10, 12 years.
So Porter was basically a dead style. And Porter, if you go back those 100 odd years, what everyone sees as the London beer, that traditional style. Mm-hmm. And, that was dead for like 80 years.
Was that because it was perceived as being a poor man's beer? I don't think I wanted to be seen drinking porter.
People just started drinking lighter styles of beer, just like everywhere else in the world. Those dark, heavy beers were great in winter, but they're not designed for quenching your thirst. So.
But also, stout started off as a type of porter. You know, it was a
fortified porter, right?
Guinness and the stout, you know, really kind of took over that market, and porters died off as a result. And it was only the kind of, you know, bringing back the deader style, you know, and I think Fuller's did a fantastic job.
I think they did, yeah.
Because I think my first, after leaving London, coming back here, of idea of a proper London porter was the Meantime Porter, which is a beer I really love as
Another terrific beer.
Yeah.
And a newish craft brewery, so.
But they do a lot of, for craft brewery, they do a lot of sort of more traditional English style, don't they?
I think so, yeah.
Their IPA is very much not in the US tradition, it's in the UK tradition.
And the London, you know, they've got a real affinity with London as well. Yeah. You know, they're based in Greenwich, and you know, they really do play on their London roots in that sort of way. And you know, I think their porter is also fantastic. It's a bit stronger than this one. It's 6.5% compared to this 5.4. But both of them, I think, are terrific beers.
Nice. Yeah.
The label says rich, dark, and complex, and that's how I would describe it.
Yeah. That's pretty spot on.
But also, I think, you know, the uniqueness is that you've got the hop characteristics in there as well, which is not something you necessarily associate with the traditional English style.
No.
And what I really like about porter is that, you know, it's got that extra string to its bow. It's not just a dark licorice stout and, you know, very malty, and it's got the hop characteristics as well.
I've always been a massive stout fan over porters, but I have been coming around to porters recently.
This is
a really good one, I have to say.
Lately I've been in the same way. I'm definitely more of a porter fan.
Yeah,
and stouts.
When you go back to those early days of Camera, those the big six breweries, Guinness was one of those big six breweries, but Guinness was the only one that didn't buy own any pubs.
Yeah.
And what Guinness did is it had deals with all the other big breweries, and basically you could get Guinness in every single pub in Britain.
That's true.
Like, wherever you went, you could actually get Guinness. So it was a huge selling beer. One single beer. That's all we did. And, you know, just totally took over that market.
Why would you need to buy the breweries? You just get the one beer into every pub.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So Guinness's business plan was very different.
It seems pretty intelligent.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's still paying off today.
Mm. Yeah, it's still there. It's still in every single pub.
It's in a lot of pubs around the world as well. Like, it's hard to find... Like, there are lots of pubs in Sydney that have Guinness on a nitro pour.
Absolutely. It's the same all over the world.
And there are some terrific stouts being made in the UK, but they can't get the tax
because,
base.
Because there's Guinness.
The market's Guinness is there. Wanted, yeah.
And it's hard to do more than one stout in any pub, really. Absolutely. Like, it's...
Yep. Is, yeah.
Yep, having absolutely. More than one stout on tap is a bit...
Some publicans in the UK will tell you they can't support any dark beer, you know.
Wow.
It's only the light stuff that, and the brown bitters that sell. And, you know, they won't turn over a cask-conditioned stout or porter in time.
Simple stuff.
Yeah, which I really enjoyed that beer. That's amazing.
It is a shame, yeah.
I remember, I mean, Fuller's are always quite a big advocate of Cask Beer Week in the UK, which is something that Camera obviously recognises, but it doesn't carry the real ale name. It's Cask Beer Week. And I do remember on a couple of occasions chasing round Fuller's tied houses in London trying to find London Porter on cask because it was coming on in different pubs on cask form. And I remember finding it in a pub. It was actually in the shadow of the Millennium Dome in Greenwich.
Oh, nice.
And I managed to find it. I sat with the sun setting in front of me and across London, sipping on my pint of cask London Porter.
How was
and
it?
It was as good as I had hoped it to be.
Nice.
It was fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Well, whenever I fly into London, it's like straight into a feeling like Fuller's London Pride will almost always be the first beer that I'll have because, you know, Fuller's just make fantastic beers. Yeah. So.
Fuller's do make fantastic beers, and London Pride, when you get it right, is a fantastic beer. And I do think, however, that London Pride does suffer a little bit by, you know, a victim of its own success. It finds its way into pubs where the cellarman can't keep a decent pint of beer, and therefore, if you end up in one of these pubs, or if you're someone who's not familiar with cask beer and happened to order a pint of London Pride in one of these pubs where it's been sat in the the pipes a bit too long, you're not going to get a very good beer.
That's exactly right.
And you know, that's the issue with cask beer.
It's a huge issue with cask.
The bigger it gets, the more likely you are to find a beer that's not on form.
Well, like, yeah, I think there's a lot of trust taken away from the brewery and into the bar with cask beers, more than tap beers. Like, tap beers are a lot more forgiving. Like, yeah, like the Marston's pub that I worked in, we had, like, a beer technician who'd come from Marston's, who'd come around, like, I think every fortnight and inspect our taps and had the power to shut down the pub if the cask went up to scratch.
Yeah.
And, like, he was a nice guy, but, if he thought there was something funny going on, it'd just shut you down.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he could have the power.
Close the doors!
Because they would rather close
everybody
the doors
out.
Than serve shit beer.
Yeah,
I mean,
fair enough.
I'm not saying Marston's is a great craft venue, but like they actually did give a shit about their beers.
I wish they kind of happened. They can't check the whole country.
No, exactly. Yeah. There's like they check their chain of pubs. They didn't go around everyone else.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's another thing we don't have here is like chains of pubs, really.
We do.
But there's
local
groups.
Tap house.
Yeah, there's groups.
No.
There's a chain.
But I mean, the classic chain in the UK is JD Weatherspoons, which has a pub in almost every town, and it generally is the worst pub in every town, with very, very few exceptions.
And you could get every one of them, I think, you get like a £2 pint of Pride.
Yeah, you can. And you can get Pride, you can get Green King, and you can get...
And they actually had some...
Green King.
You can get Pedigree, and,
they'll
have guest ales as well.
Yeah.
So they do support the guest ale market, but they also put a lot of pressure on these microbreweries to sell their beers at prices that they would never dream of selling them in other freehold pubs.
Yeah.
Just so that they can compete on price, and, you know... Yeah, that is a big difference over here in Australia. I've noticed that you don't get these kind of, you know, identikit chain pubs.
Yeah, but we have groups, but they're not, like... It's not every bar's the same. It's like you look at our big groups, not to get into like hospitality nerd speak, but like Keystone and Merrivale, Swill House, like these groups.
Yeah.
But all their venues are different.
Those ones are still quite small chains. I mean, you look at something like ALH.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, which is like a proper network.
But even then, they're not cookie cutter pubs. Like
They're not, but they've all got a lot of similarities.
Yeah, they do.
It's like, you know, if you look at the taps and, like, you know, you sit there in a pub, and those pubs for quite a wee while, you suddenly go, oh, yeah, this is... Yeah. You can actually pick it up.
They don't actually hide it in the UK, you know?
I mean,
the Weatherspoons are quite open to the fact that it's a Weatherspoons pub. Yeah. It's the thing is, you know in there, you know what you're going to order off the menu before
you
walk
in
every one of them.
Yeah.
They've actually got a sponsorship deal with HP. Mm-hmm. Like, it's actually had the proper HP logos on the menus and everything. Like, you know what you're going to get. You can walk into one no matter where you are.
The printer company?
Printer company, yeah.
I guess it's kind of like that McDonald's idea.
It is.
Though.
It is like a franchise.
You can walk into anyone, anywhere in the world.
That's sort of what I mean.
Exactly
you don't have those franchise... Like, I don't know. You have chain pubs, you have group pubs, but you don't... They're not franchises. They're not like, oh, I'm going to this place because it's ALH.
Yeah. But to some extent, is that not what Guinness have gone for as well, though? You know, you can go into any pub in the world and you can get a pint of Guinness and you pretty much know how that Guinness is going to be poured and how it's going to taste.
Pretty much, yeah.
So what happens in a HP pub? Do you like, oh, I'm sorry, we're not pouring right at the moment, we're waiting for a technician to fix our taps. And he doesn't know how to fix it either.
You buy the glass, but then you pay lots for what goes in it.
Yeah.
The glass is free.
Yeah, the glass is free, yeah.
And it comes with quarter filled.
Yeah.
No, the keg system is free, but the beer is like $50 a glass or something.
Like more expensive than oil. Hey guys, Tom here. We went quite a way over time on this episode, so we split it up into two parts, and we'll release the second part as the next episode. So thanks for listening.